Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Iowa legislature wrapped up a shortened and interrupted session this year, finishing up on Sunday. We'll hear from local lawmakers, Republican State Senator Jim Carlin, and Democratic State Representative Chris Hall about the debate over the budget, abortion, absentee voting, felons' rights, and more. But first, an update on the spread of the coronavirus in a hot spot in northwest Iowa. New cases of the coronavirus continue to slowly decline in Iowa, but Buena Vista County is seeing the highest rate of COVID-19 infection in the state. About 8% of the more than 20,000 residents have tested positive for the coronavirus. As of Wednesday, 10 people have died. The head of the local health department is Pam Bogue. The administrator of Buena Vista County Public Health and Home Care talked with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer about the illness in the community and the potential for improvement in infection numbers.
Last week, after the governor's announcement of opening more up within our communities, and we were looking at our numbers, which were climbing every single day, I did start reaching out to them about some special attention for our county. Specifically, I was asking for some messaging from them that specifically addressed our county. And then also we visited about collecting some data. So they did reach out and they did do that data collection for us as well. What that data is showing is that there is a possibility that we may have hit our peak and we may be headed down. We need to give that some time to make sure that that is correct. And I know a lot of their interpretation of that came from hospital. And because at the time when they did the data collection, our numbers were still going up. But they looked at a multitude of different areas to make that suggestion or to inform us of the possibility. So we're hopeful that that's what's going to happen.
What would you advise people? Because you're kind of on the front lines of what's going on.
Okay, I guess I just think that this is something that's not going to go away in a day or week or even a month. We're going to be working with COVID in our communities for a while until we have a vaccine that is going to be a preventative for us, or if we find out that enough people have gotten ill and built up an immunity. Right now, we don't know what the immunity is for once you've had COVID-19, whether you know it's good for a while or whether it's good for 2 months and you can get it again. So all those things are new because this is a brand new virus. So I would just remind our community, I know that we've talked about these things over and over again, all of the things that we can do to our mitigation strategies to try to decrease. So everything from washing your hands, not touching your face, wearing a mask if you're less than 6 feet away from somebody, try to keep that social distance more than 6 feet if possible. Being alert to your health, and if you are sick, stay home. You know, we kind of think it's going to happen to somebody else, but I think this COVID has actually surprised quite a few people as far as it did happen to me. Now, on May 13th, we had 75 cases. So we jumped from 75 to this huge number in 4 weeks, probably over 1,600. A lot for, you know, our county's only a little over 20,000. So that's a lot of people, but we have been doing a lot of testing as well. I don't think that's the sole reason for our numbers being so high, but I definitely feel it contributes. We've had testing. Tyson has done their own testing, and that they've gone through reporting that to the state once they get their results. And then also we've had Test Iowa for several weeks, and they're still going to be in town through next week. And then our agency was helping our long-term care facilities do testing of their staff and their residents as well. So we've been doing lots of testing in our county. And, you know, that does increase your numbers, but we see a lot of now community spread. Households that have several people within the household that are positive, and sometimes whole households. And we do have some multifamily households in our community as well. So those especially get hard hit because there's more people living close together.
And once again, you're not releasing specifics of age or gender for people who have died.
No, and we are not doing that because of our size. You know, Woodbury County is a lot bigger than we are, and they routinely have a lot of deaths, you know, on a daily basis, just their natural amounts. But in a smaller community like we are, it's so easy to figure out who it is, and that's something that's public, that's health information that we're required by law to keep private. So because of that, we don't release it in our county.
That's Pam Bogue, the administrator of Buena Vista County Public Health and Home Care, talking about COVID-19 in Buena Vista County. After the interview with Siouxland Public Media News, Buena Vista County confirmed outbreaks at 2 long-term care centers. They posted a news release on social media saying the Iowa Department of Public Health and Buena Vista County Public Health and Home Care identified 3 cases of COVID-19 at Pleasant View Home in Albert City and 3 cases of COVID-19 at Good Samaritan Society, Newell. According to the state, an outbreak occurs when 3 or more cases of COVID-19 are identified among residents of a facility. The facilities have notified residents and their families. Consistent with state guidelines, the affected residents are in isolation. Pleasant View Home staff and Good Samaritan Society staff are working closely with IDPH and Buena Vista County Public Health to protect the health of all residents and staff, with additional testing of residents and staff as directed by IDPH. The Walmart in Storm Lake made a post about the outbreak in the community on Facebook saying Buena Vista has been hit especially hard by COVID-19. The store closed Tuesday afternoon and will reopen on Thursday for deep sanitation. Walmart was already conducting health screenings and temperature checks on employees who will wear face masks and gloves. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The 2020 session of the Iowa legislature adjourned belatedly on Sunday night. Lawmakers were sent home in March to try and stem the spread of the coronavirus and worked distantly for 2 months. Lawmakers returned recently to the State House and hurriedly passed a slew of bills on several issues, including abortion, voting rights, and addressing police brutality. Democratic Sioux City State Representative Chris Hall says the issue of reinstating voting rights for felons did not progress in this session. After lawmakers adjourned, Governor Kim Reynolds said she planned to issue an executive order that would deal with felon voting rights. Hall says he's glad the governor decided to do that.
My understanding is that Senate Republicans let a bill that would have restored felon voting rights die. That bill was not fully agreed upon and not something that a lot of more progressive legislators believed was the right bill to move forward. So it does sound like that legislation is dead, and if actions are going to be taken on restoring felon voting rights, they would come from the governor's office in the form of an executive order.
It seems like until recently, the governor really wanted the legislature to pass a bill to have an amendment instead of going ahead and signing an executive order to restore felon voting rights. So this is kind of a turnaround.
The governor asked the legislature to work on it, and her preference was to find something that would be permanent and also have legislative approval. And that is a conversation that has been taking place for probably 20 years or almost 20 years. Since Governor Tom Vilsack originally signed that executive order, because the legislature was unwilling to take up such a bill. The dynamics of that conversation and what the legislature really worked on had pretty different, there were some significant differences. Senate Republicans were unwilling to go forward with a bill that really gave full restoration upon an individual's completion of you know, paying their debts to society. They included some language with financial requirements, paying full restitution, paying of court fees and things of that sort. And a lot of people were opposed to that proposal because we felt that putting such stiff financial penalties on an individual who is simply trying to become, you know, a full and participating member of society, it was just too high of a hurdle and one that made made it feel much more like a poll tax. I did not support the compromise proposed by Senate Republicans because of that. I thought it was still something that would prevent a lot of individuals from having their rights restored. And unfortunately, the people who would have the hardest time with that process are people who are poor or people of color. I think it's in response to a real heightened awareness and concern for the disparities that exist in our country and also here in Iowa. We know that people of color are incarcerated at a significantly higher rate in this state, and they're also experiencing a higher rate of felony charges than people who are white. And if that's the case, and this bill doesn't allow for them to have their rights fully restored and instead puts financial penalties on them, it's only going to further the disparities. It's not going to resolve them. And that's why an executive order might be the best compromise. It has been in the past, and it might still be.
And there was also, you guys passed very quickly, this reform, law enforcement reform, that would hopefully kind of protect people who are under arrest, especially people of color. That seemed to have been a unanimous thing, right?
It was. It was historic and really a special thing to watch move through the legislature, both in conversation and in actual lawmaking. The package that moved through both chambers unanimously with Republican and Democratic support took action on a few things that we know will help improve safety, especially for Black men in this state. It bans police chokeholds. It makes it illegal to rehire police who have been fired for misconduct. It would allow the Attorney General to investigate misconduct if a local prosecutor is not able to. And it also requires annual implicit bias and de-escalation training for law enforcement officers. This is something that was done with a lot of consultation, both from law enforcement and the Attorney General's office. And I think the unanimous show of support reflects that good work.
A big partisan issue always, and, you know, divides the legislature most of the time, is abortion. And this 24-hour wait was passed for women who want to get an abortion. And it was interesting because I was watching in the Senate when they were discussing a bill that had to do with whether or not the time that would have to elapse or what you'd have to do to shut off life support to a minor who was, you know, officially, you know, brain dead, et cetera. People started saying, well, I don't know if this is something that you guys are going to bring up. Also, you're going to bring up an abortion bill. They said, I feel an abortion bill in the offing. And sure enough, there was an abortion bill.
There's something odd about a legislature that is predominantly held by, you know, white men across the state. And the only thing that year after year seems to allow them to be able to find an ultimate compromise and eventually adjourn is further restricting a woman's right to make her own healthcare decisions. It's something that we've seen several years of recent, and something that Republican lawmakers who I speak with are frustrated by. This is not something that a lot of Republicans really thought was the right thing to move forward with, nor the way that they wanted to end the legislative session. But they were forced into that position by a small number of very conservative Republican lawmakers in the state Senate. And it's something that I think we need to be more thoughtful about the decisions that are made in the final days of session, and especially those that happen late in the middle of the night and haven't been fully considered or made public.
There are a couple of issues that you and several other Democratic lawmakers were concerned about. One that would give certain businesses, meatpackers, nursing homes, et cetera, a certain amount of immunity from lawsuits related.
Yes. You know, we had some very important and timely topics that needed to be addressed by the legislature. And many of them dealt with how the state responds to a public pandemic. I think most of us know that certain immunities need to be provided to business owners and property owners across the state who have really been working hard throughout this period to keep their customers, their employees safe. And those are the people, the good actors who have been working hard to make sure that their place of business is one that opens safely and starts to reengage in the economy. Those are the folks that really do deserve to have legal protections and immunity from frivolous lawsuits. Instead of just protecting those folks, though, the legislature went one step further and gave very broad-reaching immunities and legal protection to people who have also been abusing the system. When we talk about some of these widespread outbreaks that have happened in meatpacking plants and grain distilleries and processing facilities, they could have been prevented if better information was provided to the public. And instead of putting a firmer set of restrictions and workplace policies in place to help these workers and help the public stay healthy, they just gave them legal immunity and blanket immunity to the folks who have also been putting their employees in a very unsafe condition.
And you were also concerned about the fact that it's pretty much a status quo budget this year. Some Republicans said they don't want to add more to it because they don't know what's coming in the future and they don't want to overspend.
The level of spending in the status quo budget is something I think most of us do agree on. We want to hold harmless, everybody that we are able to, and make sure that the budget is just status quo without new sorts of expenses. But the challenge and decision that the Republicans made this year is to, instead of as a legislature follow their constitutional obligation to create a budget, they turned that responsibility over to the governor and unelected members of her staff. It is an $8 billion budget, and we've received close to $3 billion of federal funds. And rather than the legislature really holding on to its very long-held obligation to be the ones in charge of making a budget, they punted on it. And the reason that's unfortunate is it provides no transparency to the public on how their dollars are being spent, but it also gives the legislature no opportunity to weigh in or no safety valve in case they disagree with a decision that has been made by the governor's office. We as elected officials in the legislature are closest to the public and on the ballot most often, and we need to be the ones creating a budget that's responsive to the public's interests and needs.
That was Democratic State Representative Chris Hall of Sioux City talking about the just-ended 2020 legislative session. Republican State Senator from Siouxland Jim Carlin says he's glad lawmakers were able to accomplish as much as they did, including the passage of a bill aimed at preventing police brutality, especially against African Americans.
It was probably the best we could come up with. You know, we're only going to be there a few days. Governor's office thought it was appropriate. Leadership thought it was appropriate, and we did the best we could with the time that we had, and we were able to put together something. And you know, down the road, I don't know if there's going to be additional legislation coming as well.
Also, that the whole issue with the voting bill and that the bill that Senator Smith had put forth, and a lot of controversy surrounding that bill, and that bill went through, but not in the form that it was originally written, right?
No. It became part of a budget bill instead of a standalone out of the state committee. I think that was more or less done as a way of expediting it. You know, the inside baseball of why it was done that way, I can't really speak to. It was heavily debated on the floor, and it was made part of the budget bill.
Now, I read that there was a bill that you were the only Republican to oppose.
The COVID bill, the COVID liability bill. I really didn't have an issue with liability protections for reopening businesses out of concern for COVID. I mean, I understood that, but as you know, I'm also a trial lawyer, and there was a provision in that bill for how medical expenses in any civil injury jury case would be presented. And what I was concerned about was part of the COVID liability protection bill had a bill that specifically addresses medical expenses in civil injury cases, and the jury would only know the amount that had to be paid back to the insurance carrier or any balances that were still due and owing. So the issue I have is, you know, when you sit in a jury, a lot of juries think we'll just multiply whatever they have to pay back, you know, that's somewhat proportionate to evaluate their other damages in a case. Well, if you have somebody who has, you know, very good health insurance and you have somebody who has Medicaid, I don't think that juries are going to look at the case fairly, because one's going to be proportionately favored. The guy with the better health insurance is going to get a better number in front of the jury. And the other concern I had is they're not going to see the itemized billing for all the treatment. So I don't know if I'm clear enough for you on this, but you could have people with identical injuries. One has Medicaid, one has, you know, let's say Blue Cross Blue Shield, and the jury is only going to know about the number that has to be paid back. And that could result, in my mind, in disparate outcomes for the same case, you know, in substance. And I just didn't think that that was fair.
Could I circle back on that absentee voting thing again? Because I don't think I just wanted to make it clear to everyone who is listening, because I was following it last week, and it basically in the beginning it talked about preventing the Secretary of State, Paul Pate, from, you know, once again doing the thing where he mailed out request forms to all registered voters, right? That's kind of how it started.
My issue with that, and I'll tell you why I did vote for the bill. So presently right now, the average Iowan probably gets 4 to 6 of those absentee ballot requests. I don't know how many you've gotten, but usually in both parties, who's ever running for Senate is going to make sure people get those. Congressmen on both parties will make sure that their constituent base on their side of it is going to get them. And the county auditor's office is going to make sure that they get them, and they don't have to, but, you know, at the end of the day, does the state of Iowa really need to pay to send out another absentee ballot request when people are already getting 3 or more of them? You know, I mean, that's just reality, and I don't think we need to go to that expense.
I think people thought it was a great thing because so many people actually voted in this primary. I mean, I heard that from a lot of people.
No, I think that we had a better turnout at the primary than we anticipated. And I think in light of the whole COVID thing, the one thing that Sioux City did that I did not like at all was we had only 2 voting places. Is that right? We had one in Sergeant Bluff, and I don't know where the other one was.
Down at Long Lines.
If the concern is COVID, why would you have less polls so those 2 polls are more crowded? And they were. Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So Pat Gill could probably answer that one.
Were you surprised that there was a abortion bill this time, the 24-hour waiting bill?
I mean, you know, I'm pro-life, and I wanted to see a life amendment, which is not a ban on abortion. It just says that there's not a fundamental right to an abortion under the state constitution, which does not bar abortions. But the significance of that is, you know, in the state Medicaid funding and state funding of abortions, the state wouldn't be required to pay for it. And when we presented the heartbeat bill, one of the arguments that was made was, well, women have a fundamental right to an abortion, and we're going to apply a strict scrutiny test. So when you apply a strict scrutiny test, there's virtually no chance of overcoming the law as it's interpreted by the court at that time. So, you know, with the 24-hour waiting period, just to give you a little context on that, that has been upheld in other federal jurisdictions. A 24-hour waiting period, I think, is a good idea, because it gives sometimes women that get abortions are dealing with a lot of stress and pressure. And I don't think 24 hours is an unreasonable amount of time for somebody to have to wait. I'm definitely not in favor of abortion, but at the same time, I don't think a 24-hour waiting period where you can really consider the big picture implications of what you're about to do, you get that opportunity.
I guess the final thing was, you know, a lot of Democrats were upset. They said because of the status quo budget, they didn't feel like enough money, enough of the budget was increased in various areas, and they had so many costs, the state did, because of COVID. I guess there's really, it's pretty much likely to be signed by the governor, I'm thinking, right?
Oh, sure it will. Well, you know, the thing that people need to remember, obviously, with COVID, we just got our REC numbers back, Mary, like last week, week and a half ago. So when the economy of your state is absolutely tanking because of corn prices, decrease in demand for ethanol, bean prices are down, and then you throw into the mix that our restaurants have been closed pretty much during the entire duration of it, all the businesses have, you know, what are things going to look like 6 months or a year from now? We really don't know. And I don't think you want to do anything beyond status quo when you're really, I think it'd be irresponsible to project big numbers for things, you know, for revenue coming in that setting. And, you know, the thing is there's still an increase. We're keeping our promise on the SSA funding that we promised for school funding. We're keeping our promise with the level of Medicaid spending that's increased. So, like, the two main things that people would have concerns about, we still have significant increases. And, you know, beyond that, we just don't want to run any deficits if the money doesn't come in. So that's why we did what we did.
That was Republican Siouxland State Senator Jim Carlin talking about the 2020 legislative session that ended Sunday. I asked the District 3 lawmaker what he thought about Governor Reynolds deciding to issue an executive order that would restore felon voting rights after previously asking the legislature to come up with a bill that would do the same thing. Carlin says he believes those convicted of felony murder and felony sex abuse should be exceptions to the rule because of the damage and trauma inflicted on victims of their crimes. However, Carlin says he understands the importance of restoring a convicted felon's right to vote. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. June 19th, or Juneteenth, is the annual celebration of emancipation from slavery in the United States. There are usually celebrations and festivals in cities around the country, but the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and the killing of George Floyd at the hands of police in Minneapolis has changed the way some celebrations will go forward. Ike Rayford is the president of the Sioux City chapter of the NAACP. I asked Rayford about possible Juneteenth celebrations in Sioux City and how he thinks we should deal with the continuing issues of police brutality to African Americans in the wake of the death of George Floyd.
You know, we have always traditionally tried to have a celebration. We've always traditionally done it at Cook Park, which is, you know, located on the west side of Sioux City. And we always chose that particular park just because it was, you know, the neighborhood over there historically has, you know, been where many of our African-American families grew up, where they, you know, were from and stuff like that. Because they always have a black home from it. Sioux City also. And so, you know, we have traditionally done it over there. If it rains, we use Girls Inc., which was a great partnership with us. So, yeah, the COVID, 19 pandemic really did put a hamper, on things this year.
I was talking to the organizers of the statewide online Juneteenth celebration this year, and they said they were looking forward to having all these in-person events and having real festivals and people getting together, but it seems like between COVID and the issues over the tragic death of George Floyd, it just seems like we can't have them this year.
And that is so true. You know, like I was saying, we traditionally always have one. You know, and it's always a task because when you have communities, I mean, like Waterloo and Cedar Rapids and those places, you know, everyone is trying to do kind of their own small thing or whatever, you know, it, depending on, you know, what is going on in their city. But, you know, the state has traditionally tried to have kind of a bigger celebration. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they usually try to do kind of a week long, you know, type of things, festivities. We usually tend into city, always use that, you know, Saturday, either before or Saturday after, you know, just because it seems to work best with people. But yeah, this year has really, it seems like, as that old saying goes, if it's not one thing, it's another. And so, you know, we're just, I mean, but I think, you know, a lot of folks, in spite of what's going on, will try to do some type of, you know, recognition, observance.
The legislature did pass a bill to deal with police brutality. What do you think about the bill, and do you think it's enough?
You know, I think there's always more to be done. When you think of where we are today and where we're trying to get to, you know, there is nothing, and there is never going to be, you know, that moment where you can say, okay, it's all done. You know, I think LBJ said it best, you know, when you are trying to run a, you know, 100-yard race and you give the, you know, the person, you know, your oppressor or however you want to describe it, if you give them, you know, 50 yards, then and now you're saying, okay, let's run this race. Well, you know, we still have to make up that ground. And, you know, if everybody's moving, then, you know, those things and those issues that we've been faced is still 50, you know, yards ahead of us. So it's impossible to catch up at that point. So I think things that, you know, I am happy that, and thrilled that some things are taking place, and especially, you know, in light of all the things that have happened. But yeah, we still got a long ways to go because there's a lot. I mean, this systemic racism and systemic hate is deep. It's deep, you know. And like they say, when you're gardening, you got to pull this thing up by the root so that it doesn't continue to grow and blossom.
In the paper on Sunday, you talked about some issues you felt really needed to be worked on in the Siouxland community. You talked about healthcare. You talked about education and several other issues as well.
You know, and what you're referring to is our game changers for the NAACP. And you know, it's so important that, you know, when the NAACP, you know, leadership decided that they were going to really tackle the things that affect the African-American community, you know, health and education were definitely two of those six things. Now, here's the thing. We didn't know at the time that COVID-19 was going to be as prevalent and as big as it is. And so now even more, because we realized that the COVID-19, for whatever reason, we found that it was affecting the African-American community at a faster rate than other communities. Now, of course, we know that with COVID, that some of that has some underlying, you know, when you have some underlying health issues, well, that comes back to why we chose health, because one, you know, we have been a marginalized community, and we haven't always gotten the best health care that, you know, we deserve. We haven't always had the best doctors, even in the community. When, you know, you think about community health and community centers and stuff like that, when you go to some of these communities, especially in the big cities and things like that. It was, you know, substandard things going on. And so it's important that we look at those things that affect our community. We know that diabetes and strokes and high blood pressure are huge, you know, factors. Now, you know, we realize that we have to take some personal responsibility as well. But, you know, when we are taking that responsibility, we should at least be given, you know, grade A health care and also, you know, ways to be affordable health care. That you know, it falls right into that situation. And then you said education. Again, even as we speak, you know, Mary, Black children and children of color are really suffering from falling back. And we know that, again, you know, it's not the issue that's on top. It's the underlying things that may affect some of those things. But, you know, having technology, having economics that, you know, a family can afford to do what they need to do and feed their children. I mean, think of how many latchkey kids, you know, we have in society. And this covers everybody. And I've said this before, when we fix those things, now, obviously, you know, we talk about Black Lives Matter and these things affect our community directly. But one thing we understand is that when we fix those things for us, and guess what? It fixes it for everybody. Because we realize that there are, you know, there are kids who are white, Black, whatever, that are struggling with some of those things that causes these issues to be prevalent in their lives, whether it be health or whether it be education. And so if we fix it for one, it fixes it for all. And that's really what we're trying to really accomplish and put out there to let people know, hey, you know, if you have one of your own that's oppressed and not, you know, doing good, that's weak and weary, guess what? If you help that, it helps everybody, because now everybody's thriving.
Since the death of George Floyd, there has been a lot of youth engagement all across the country. And, you know, here in Siouxland, do you think that youth engagement has really made a big difference?
Well, I think that, again, this is for the future. You know, we hear politicians talk about, excuse me, what are we going to leave our children? What are we leaving the future generation? And now, again, you hear many politicians talking about the deficit and those things. But, you know, directly related to what's going on right now, we understand that we have to have our youth engaged, because one thing we realize is that in our community, in the Black community, that, you know, our history is very, very painful and very, and if they don't know that, we may find ourselves, you know, treading those waters again. And so, one, we want to make sure that they know where they came from and what they're up against. And so, you know, and again, if we know that, then we know that they, and also that they have the energy. Now, over the last few weeks, yeah, we've had a lot of youth step up, and we are so thankful because they have the energy. And I think I've shared this to you with you before, but, you know, even in the pre-civil rights days when they were protesting, it was the youth. It was the youth at the time who stepped up, because, you know, they had to endure some of those brutal attacks and pain with our ancestors and our older and elder generation. You know, they couldn't do it. They didn't have the stamina and the physical abilities to keep it going. So the youth have always been important, and are very important to point to our lives and our current situation.
So where will you be on Juneteenth? What kind of special things will you be doing and the NAACP be doing?
Well, you know, we always, I'm an empty nester now, so I don't, I don't, you know, but, you know, some of the members of the local chapter, we figure we're going to really push. Again, for us, you know, the work continues. And I think in honor of Juneteenth this year, you know, we're really going to try to do some membership drives. One important aspect is voting registrations. And as you see, our legislation is, you know, I mean, they're debating and fighting over absentee ballots and those things. And we're trying to make it accessible for everybody. Why is it that, you know, our current legislature is fighting, you know, and we understand, you know, we are a nonpartisan organization, but we understand that Iowa's state legislature is Republican controlled. And so it's important for voters to understand, you know, who they have represented. And I can't imagine, you know, I don't care what side of the aisle you're on, everyone should want fair, just voting and the ability to be able to cast their vote. I mean, that's the only voice that we have in society is being able to cast our votes. And yet we see people fighting and debating over that happening. So this Juneteenth, we're going to really continue to do what we've always done, but we're going to really push voter registration. We're pushing membership drives. If you know, people want to be a part of the organization, you know, this is an awesome way to celebrate Juneteenth by becoming a member of the NAACP. And then, you know, again, continuing the fight.
That was Ike Rayford, the president of the Sioux City chapter of the NAACP, talking about the Juneteenth celebrations in Sioux City and the continuing issues of police brutality to African Americans in the wake of the death of George Floyd. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Siouxland Public Media prides itself on its evening music shows. They include World Cafe, American Roots, and All Songs Considered. But there are locally produced programs as well, like 10 O'Clock Blues, Mixtape Dance Party, Moonwalk Radio, Saturday Night Jazz, and South of the Border. In January of last year, Siouxland Public Media started airing Iowa Basement Tapes late Friday nights. Host Christian Day recently talked to our local evening music host, Sheila Brummer, about his career and the music that inspires him as he puts together a weekly hour of music highlighting punk and do-it-yourself music.
I started out mainly as an obsession, my own obsession with Iowa's, I hate the word underground, but we'll say it's the underground music scene.
For all of you creeps out there.
I've been collecting this music for, you know, over 20 years, and there's a station here in Des Moines, KFMG. It's a local nonprofit station who I've done a lot of work with over the years, and I pitched them this idea of doing an Iowa music show that focused more on this type of underground scene, and not just central Iowa. It was all of Iowa, because I believe that there's scenes everywhere, and there's all this material is stored in someone's attic or basement, and it is just waiting for someone to uncover it.
And how do you decide what gets played on the show? Is it from your own stash, your own collection?
A chunk of it is from my own collection. Some of it, since I've been on, people have been literally shipping me boxes of cassettes to digitize. I have a guy who is from Cedar Falls, Waterloo, and I'm still sitting on a lot of it because it just takes so much time to get all this material digitized. And then also new music. The scenes never die. I try to find as much, and I try to also make sure I'm reaching all parts of Iowa in each playlist that I put together. And also, you know, I do kind of look for some type of commercial appeal. You know, I look for the hooks. And if I'm like, oh, man, people are going to really dig this, that's usually the first. That's the inclination that this needs to be played on the air.
You actually play some of the bands here in Siouxland, too.
Absolutely. So when I first partnered with Siouxland Public Media, I asked them, like, what do you guys got? Because I heard of maybe one or two bands, but not a whole lot. Even before Sioux City Heat, I was playing The Ruralists on my show. Dear God. Complicated. People were really into them. But again, outside of my own circle here, people didn't really know who they were. So to be able to broaden this this world of Iowa music, you know, not just in Iowa, but outside of Iowa, it's amazing to me. I mean, Sioux City has a long history in DIY and alternative music, both, you know, not just straight punk, but in even just your typical prog rock or rock and roll, it's fascinating to me.
Do you have like a favorite artist that you play on the show? If you had to pick just one?
Oh, okay. I will pick one that is still together. And they're still making music over 25 years. Captain Three Leg from Ottumwa. These guys are prolific. They've put out tons of physical releases, tons of digital releases, both of like a punk rock grindcore style to bluegrass to they even did a surf rock album. They're great. I cannot say enough about these guys.
And your day job, you actually are in the film industry.
Yeah, I've worked over 10 years in the business as a production manager, working on shows like The Bachelor.
It's about to get hot. It's about to get spicy. Let that romance commence.
I've done quite a few House Hunters episodes and then some narrative. Did a couple scripted shows for Complex Network. And HBO, and then now mainly commercials. That's mainly what I get my hands dirty with, so to speak. But it's been, I call it the circus. Some people just call it the business. It's kind of a rat race at times. And, you know, it kind of goes hand in hand, really. It's a media world, entertainment world with doing the show.
How about The Bachelor? Back on that subject, do you have any secrets that you can share? Or do they make you sign a non-disclosure?
Well, yeah, they do make you sign a non-disclosure. But I mean, it is exactly what you would think. You know, it's scripted, non-scripted. We shot the mansions over in Agoura Hills, just south of Los Angeles, near Calabasas and Malibu. You know, it's a huge show. You know, 150 crew people. And a lot of things don't necessarily transfer to other jobs. I mean, I did 5 seasons with that company. I would go out to LA and then be there for like a month, month and a half, and then they'd fly me somewhere else, some really cool places. Went to some weird places in Indiana, Dallas, went to Ireland. Those things are fun, but I can't say I'm really having a good time. I was the young guy on the totem pole, so I was working, you know, from 4 p.m. till, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning every day.
Oh yeah, that becomes a grind, doesn't it? So maybe, yeah. Maybe the punk rock is more appealing, it sounds like. For sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. I've really appreciated Siouxland Public Media being the first radio station, you know, both for KWIT and KOJI to pick up the show outside of Des Moines, and they've been great partners to work with and help spread this music across the state.
Up next, The Horrors, the first song off their self-titled album, Every Inch of My Love, right here on Iowa Basement Tapes.
That's Christian Day, host of the weekly radio show Iowa Basement Tapes, that you can hear every Friday night at 11 p.m. on Siouxland Public Media. Thanks to Sheila Brummer for her help with the program, and thanks for listening to this week's edition of The Exchange. Before we go, here's a listen to more of The Ruralists with the song Right. Have a great week. I'm Mary Hartnett.
Dear God, it's complicated. All these ventricles and veins pumping blood up to our brains. From our wild and woolly hearts. Oh Christ, the incarnated, is this what you could see in the garden on your knees, begging for another way? Do you do the right thing? You do the right thing. How do you do the right thing? You do the right thing. How do you do the right thing? You do the right thing. Right. Right.
Yeah.
twice as hard, love yourself. But if you wanna get along, then you've got to get along. 'Cause it's not like we got anybody else.